morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the CEO of the American Security Project. And welcome to our inaugural event for 2014. It's a big week for us as we're doing energy choices this morning. We're going to do EATER tomorrow on Capitol Hill, and then we're going to do defense budget on Thursday. So kicking it off with a big start. And of course, you've all braved the cold to be here, and I really appreciate it. Energy has long been an issue for the American Security Project since we started in 2005. Then Senators Kerry, Hagel, Hart, and Rudman had a strong belief that the country needed to do more on energy independence and climate change, and those have been two plank issues for us from the get-go. And we have a lot of aspects to it. We've built on the program, and we have a senior fellow that runs this particular program for us. I like to think that the government isn't quite doing enough in terms of its long-term thoughts on energy independence. Although I realize there's a glut of oil and a glut of gas, and there's a lot of parameters, and I'm sure that will come into discussion this morning. There's a lot of other things we can do in terms of energy and energy independence in this country, but I'm going to leave that to the professionals. We are going to be Twittering this. We are going to put it up on our website this afternoon, so don't worry about notes. It'll be all up there. We're taping it, so you can hit our website. Please do hit the website. There's a lot there on energy and climate, and I appreciate you taking a look at it. With that, let me turn it over to our senior fellow for energy and climate, Andrew Holland.
Great, thank you, Steve. And I'm privileged to be on the stage here with three experts in various areas of energy policy: Scott Peterson from the Nuclear Energy Institute, Todd Foley from ACOR, the American Council on Renewable Energy, and David Wachner, an expert on LNG and natural gas from K&L Gates. He's a partner at K&L Gates. The way we'll do this today is I'm going to do a brief introduction. I encourage you all to go on the website, download the report. We've joined the 21st century, and we don't really print up our reports anymore. So go download it, read it on your iPad, save a tree, and take a look through it that way. But I'd say we had two reports. The tentpole one is the America's Energy Choices, and this is our report that we've done since 2011, looking at what America is doing, the state of American energy, and what Congress and the administration should be doing, and setting out kind of a menu of policy options based on what we see as the three key ingredients, which are energy security, environmental sustainability, and economic stability. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times in D.C., we tend to pick the argument that fits the outcome we want, instead of looking at it holistically and saying, well, you know, these are all three sides of the same coin. So you can't think about one, you can't make changes to one without making changes to the other. So the other thread running through this is, when I was writing this updated report, going back to the 2011 report, there were significant changes in the energy outlook for the United States, both on the renewable side, but also on the continued production of natural gas and the boom in shale oil. This was something that really wasn't apparent at the time. So we've seen a kind of a sea change in a lot of these things, but at the same time, we've seen very little change in the politics of it. It's the same arguments, the same changes, same stuff going on the Hill. So when we talk about America's energy choices, the thing that comes through is that we made a series of choices in the 1970s based off of the energy crisis. And we haven't really, since the 70s and 80s, we haven't really made any choices. We've just coasted on these choices and let markets work. There's been, on renewable energy, there's been a big investment in the stimulus, for instance, but then a pendulum swings back and that pulls back. And what we need is a sustainable long-term choice to go in a different direction or to stay in a direction instead of this kind of argument back and forth. Yesterday we came out with a report called The Five Choices We Need to Make, basically going through this, and I'll quickly say, you know, one choice is fossil fuel exports. Do we want to do fossil fuel exports? Do we want to rationalize fossil fuel exports? Does it make sense to have a system where the DOE has oversight over natural gas exports, Department of Commerce has oversight over oil exports, and nobody has oversight over coal exports? Building new energy infrastructure. Keystone's only the most visible part of this, but you know, we're seeing price spikes in natural gas here in up in New England and the Northeast, and part of that is because there isn't enough infrastructure built to bring the natural gas to them. Third, ensuring safe storage of nuclear waste. This is, I think, one of the prime things that we haven't made the decision on, and Congress was told to make a decision under law by 1998 on what to do with our waste. So I'm going to ask Scott to weigh in on that a bit more. Fourth, future of support for renewable energy. Which direction are we going to do? How are we going to support it? Are we going to leave it up to the states? Are we going to have a big push up the federal level? And then fifth, scientific research into next generation energy. The idea that our mix of energy today is going to be the same as it is in 2040, 2050, which is what you see when you look at, you know, the BP or ExxonMobil, Shell looking out. It's always keep the lines going. And I think that the history of energy transitions of any sort, is not that. It's you hit a tipping point, and then it moves from geometric growth to exponential growth. I think we are seeing almost exponential growth in solar deployment in the United States. So with that, I think this is all interesting. I could keep talking for the whole hour, but I'm not going to do that. And I've got lots of great charts in the energy choices, but go online and get those and look at that. I didn't want to do PowerPoint today because, you know, it's cold outside and it's early in the morning. We don't want to put everybody to sleep. So what I'm going to do is just ask our three panelists here to kind of comment on some of what I said, bring up whatever they want, talk about what's going on, and I'm going to do it in the order they're seated here. So Scott, I'll turn it over to
you and
let you go.
Thank you, Andrew. Good morning, everybody. I think, you know, given the experience we've had in the last two or three weeks and likely will continue today, there's a big focus on reliability of electric supply. We've seen records being set across many of the power companies, particularly in the Southeast with Duke Energy and Tennessee Valley Authority. Where there's perhaps a greater use of electricity to heat homes. But we're also seeing really tight demand. The power grids in the Mid-Atlantic and New England areas setting record demands for the use of gas when they can get it. And I think what we're really seeing here is the value in the electricity sector of diversity of supply and why that's an absolute necessity for our country going forward. Because when we have these periods where certain electricity generators do not perform to their peak, there are others who can come in and fill that void and keep the electricity flowing when it's needed most. So I think the core value that we have in this country in our electricity sector, and one we need to make sure that we retain, is the diversity of supply and the diversity of technology that we use to generate electricity. And so when you think about reliability and you think about affordability, and those are really the two drivers for consumers, we certainly believe that nuclear energy has a role to play there. We've seen that role very vividly in the last few weeks, first as the polar vortex moved in and as those companies that I mentioned earlier, both heavily vested in nuclear energy, were able to meet winter peak demands in their service areas. So, you know, the diversity of technology and fuel supply is critical as we look at the next 20 to 25 years, where in the electric sector, we'll essentially be investing as much capital as we've invested in the grid to date. So heavy, heavy investment that's going to be needed for new transmission, for environmental retrofits, for new generation capacity. And so we've got a critical period ahead of us, and as Andrew said, we have to approach this smartly so that we get it right as we go through that transition. And by the way, we're doing that in a way that really accentuates the need for cleaner electricity generation, not only to meet the carbon goals that the administration has, but also to meet a number of state-based and regional climate goals that are out there. So we're going to see this shift toward cleaner electricity generation. We believe at NEI that there's a role for all of those sources in that shift, and our primary driver, of course, is nuclear. But most of our members, we have about 375 members that we support, have a full range of electricity production across that diversity of technology and fuels. So that's why we believe, and they believe, that diversity is a critical issue. Now, when you look at what's going on in terms of some of the decision making in energy, it's, as Andrew said, it's very, very difficult to tackle this issue in Congress. There are party differences, there are regional differences, there's just about every difference that you can imagine that comes into play in setting energy policy. So really no substantive energy policy since the last Energy Policy Act in 2005. We've been using some of that policy in our industry to build new reactors. So we're building 5 new reactors, all of those in the Southeast. We are still trying to leverage the loan guarantee program at the Department of Energy for one of those projects, even though it's almost halfway finished. But the Southern Company very much believes that if they can use that loan guarantee to help finance the project, they can still accrue significant savings to consumers for using that loan guarantee. So we'll continue to try to leverage some of the aspects of the Energy Policy Act. When you look at short-term decision-making, though, that's really happening in our industry today, it does have consequences. In our business, last year, there were 4 reactors that were shut down, 2 of those in California, the San Onofre reactors, which had technical issues with steam generators, but they also had some really difficult issues with getting timely decisions from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to be able to have a certain path or path forward of certainty toward restart of those reactors. So absent that certainty, and the $1 million a day they had to pay to buy power from the grid, they simply couldn't afford to continue down that path of fixing steam generators without the regulatory certainty that they needed. So what's the impact of that to California? Taking those 2 reactors off the grid has resulted in a 35% increase in carbon emissions in the state. That's not the only reason why carbon emissions are up, but that's a significant reason why carbon will continue to go up in California. So obviously we believe that nuclear energy must be part of this diverse electricity mix. We've done some polling recently that shows Americans have the same expectation. 82% believe that nuclear energy has an important role to play. 8 out of 10 Americans believe that we should be planning for our electricity future 10 years or more out. Half of those people think we should be planning on a 20-year horizon, and a lot of the electric utilities are in the middle of that planning horizon, particularly those that continue to operate in regulated states and have an obligation to do that. So let me just finish with a little bit of the value proposition of nuclear energy and why we think it's an important component of our electricity system. Our plants operate at industry-leading efficiency levels, so if you look at 100% of the time that you could produce electricity 24/7 every day of the year, nuclear plants as a fleet, so all 100 reactors across the country are operating at about 88% efficiency, by far the industry leading figure among all power plants. The result of that is we produced nearly 800 billion kilowatt hours of electricity last year from those 100 reactors. That's enough to power about 20% of the country. Exelon, which is the leading nuclear operator in this country with 17 reactors, just released their 2013 operational data. They operated at 94% capacity factor for their 17 reactors, and that's about as high as you can get, given that you have refueling and maintenance outages that that cut that number down. 134 billion kilowatt hours just from that one utility, enough to serve 15 million homes. So that's really the power of nuclear energy in terms of producing large-scale electricity around the clock. You add to that the forward price stability, because uranium fuel does not fluctuate in price in wild swings, and because we refuel reactors only 18 to 24 months, we can hedge the price swings that we have. So the price stability, when you look forward of nuclear energy, is very stable, and that's important when you're looking at managing economic development. Nuclear energy provides nearly two-thirds of all carbon-free electricity in this country, so a significant driver in how we're going to meet our carbon goals. It maintains grid stability, which, again, is important when you're looking at when the transmission system is stressed on days like today and when you have those hot summer days. And there are economic drivers in the communities in which they serve. One of the real, I think, shames of our electricity sector is that we have reactors today in competitive states that if they were in regulated states would still be operating, but they have either shut down or will be shut down this year. One in Wisconsin, one in Vermont. And what you're starting to see in those communities is real panic over the fact that these facilities, largely in rural communities, are the jobs drivers. They're a huge part of the tax base. And so when these facilities are closed, there's a real dearth of economic stability in those communities because that facility goes away. And so we're starting to see some awareness of that around the country now in terms of what happens, not only when you take that power off the grid, but what happens to communities when these facilities go away. So with that, I think I'll close, given the time, and
thanks,
we'll have some questions.
Perfect. Thank you. Todd Foley from ACOR.
Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Good morning, everybody. Great to be here and talk about, I think, really what is a very exciting time in energy. We are in the midst of an energy revolution with the advent of a host of new technologies and improvements in older technologies. And I'm really reminded that it's really very much led by the private sector, the investors and the companies out there that make these things happen. Because I think, Andrew, to your point when we started here, the policy framework, however, is rooted back in the 70s, in many respects. I was reminded on October 16th, just this few months ago, was the 40th anniversary of the Arab oil embargo. Mm-hmm. And that came about from the Israeli Arab conflict earlier that month, where you had OPEC freeze production and eliminate shipments to certain to the U.S. and other places. It woke us all up in a huge, huge way, of course. Henry Kissinger on October 16th actually spoke about that, here in D.C., so he's reminded of that in our introduction here. And I remember that very well. I was a little kid growing up in the desert of Vegas, and I had a mini bike, and I used to pay 32 cents a gallon. We had to take a gas can down to the gas station, and it cost 32 cents to fill that gas can up. Exactly what it was, right? With the oil, with all of a sudden, the price shot up to it was like a dollar something when I could get it. And I remember we had rationing where you could only buy gas every other day depending on your license plate. Mm-hmm. And the lines were massive. So I remember feeling that very, very deliberately, very specifically as a kid. And, that oil shock that impact it had on energy here is what drove the early investments in alternatives. It was, as Henry Kissinger and others said, we need to diversify, we can't be solely dependent on oil. So that really spawned the significant R&D programs on the power side, looking at alternatives, but also on the transportation side, fuel side. Interesting thing, when Kissinger spoke a couple months ago, You know, when they asked him, well, where were we at now? And he said, well, we have much more ability to deal with shocks. We've built in resiliency. But we still need to focus on making improvements in energy. Though the same impetus for that, you know, continues. Not exactly for the same reason, but that's still very important. And I think, you know, for renewable energy, that was really essentially pretty much the beginning. Because as I think we all know, energy, and you say this, Andrew, in your paper, you know, energy is fully dependent on policy. It's the most highly regulated, most highly incentivized, most policy-oriented probably activity of all. And, you know, this notion that we have a free market, we need to look at that a little bit more closely because it is all driven by policy. Now, the policy sets the framework in which the market can compete. So the government is setting the rules across the board, wholesale markets, retail markets, affecting all energy, and that's been the case since the beginning of modern energy. You know, and thinking of the power side, dating back to Edison and Tesla and Westinghouse, because they were encouraged to take electricity across the country, fully a policy support. And then we see government playing a role in energy development since. Now, I would also contend that, I think maybe we all would, but that, you know, energy is quite fundamental. I worked at BP before I joined Acor, and we talked about energy being fundamental to light, heat, and mobility. You know, it is, couldn't be more fundamental. It's also fundamental to our economy and our well-being. So that we would be neutral, the country, the government would be neutral on energy, that just doesn't make any sense. So it is a function of policy. Now, the renewable energy has come a long way over the years, of course, and I think we have a terrific value proposition. We provide energy security. We provide environmental security. When you think about renewable energy helps deal with ambient air issues as well as global climate issues. Provides economic security in that these are very important growing industry, new technology that is paving the way for a different kind of future. Renewable energy captures all of that. And I think when we think about energy going forward, you know, that's how we need to look at it. We now have more choices than we've ever had. We look at our policy choices, we do need to look at what they do to provide, you know, energy security, the environment, and the economy. I would just say that on that front, we've heard there's so much excitement going on around the natural gas and a shale boom, and huge excitement about that, of course, and what it means for our economic, our energy independence, both for oil and gas. Well, I would just say on renewable energy, we're as equally excited. We've had tremendous progress in renewable energy. The United States is the Saudi Arabia of renewable energy. We have some of the strongest wind resources in the world. We have also some of the strongest solar resources also in the world. And then you think about biomass and geothermal as well, massive amount of domestic renewable energy that we can harness. What we've seen, the issue there is, of course, is what's the policy framework to promote development of that? Because as I said, all of energy development, consumption is a factor of policy. And right now, of course, it's well known, renewable energy is probably dealing with some of the greatest uncertainty, certainly in the energy market. And I would actually say the whole energy market is dealing with a great deal of uncertainty as Congress and the country tries to figure out where we want to go. On the conventional side, thinking of tax reform, the energy policy element there, that debate has been raised. Not sure when resolution will take place. We've got decisions. The president's looking at decisions on the XL pipeline, and then on renewable energy, of course, we face on our very important tax credits, having to renew them regularly. The wind tax credit has expired on December 31st, 2013. You know, it's not in place right now, again. And despite that, and solar has been in place, it was extended in 2008 through 2016, But we're now feeling the pinch of that expiration, because for large projects, on the way the project pipeline, project cycle works, timeline, you needed to, if you haven't started them and you haven't done a lot of work on them, you can't get there in time to ensure that you're going to get the tax credit by the beginning of 2017. That policy, and then now also EPA, just a couple months ago, has introduced great uncertainty into the biofuels market, with its annual targets lowered for the first time for biofuels. In November, the EPA proposed a lower overall renewable biofuels for the first time, and this sends another huge level of uncertainty into the biofuels market. So when you think about companies and entrepreneurs and financiers investing in these technologies, that chills that, and has a huge impact going forward. I can go on a long time about this, but I won't. But despite all this uncertainty, and I think this is really important, so I'm hoping we all get back on track. Despite this huge level of uncertainty, the industry has really stepped up. And again, I think we all know policy lags innovation in the market and business. And the business guys in the renewable energy space are just doing unbelievable things. Over the last 10 years or so, there have been more than $300 billion invested in U.S. Renewable energy. So it's a massive number, big number. There's been huge, huge progress. In 2012, renewable energy deployment surpassed all other sources. More than 49% of all new power capacity added in 2012 came from renewable energy, surpassing all other sources, including natural gas. So in terms of materiality and scale, renewable energy is there. At the same time, and what's going on with this is that costs have come dramatically down. Wind costs have come down 40% since 2008, more than 40%. Solar has come down more than 80% since 2008. And on a levelized cost basis, solar and wind are now fully competitive with conventional sources of energy. So we're there. Wind is being deployed first in the Midwest. It's cheaper than gas and coal on a new basis. Solar is being bid in cheaper than coal and gas in the West. So the industry has stepped up the game, has really invested, is deploying. We do need to resolve the policy, though, with this. Right now in the policy front, we've got some very significant issues, as I mentioned, the PTC, ITC, and then of course we have the draft discussions and papers that have come out on tax reform, talking about significant reform to these tax credits. And on the one hand, it's good, of course, that we're seeing Senator Bach as the chair of the Finance Committee and supporting continued policy, but there's a significant change in that. It's not really too clear yet what impact that would have on the market. I would note that the single tax credit would either be a production for power, would be based on output or production, like the PTC for wind. But there's also an ITC element that is significantly lower, about 33% lower than the current ITC. So anyway, it's uncertain how this would work, but there's a lot of uncertainty. I think what's happening in the industry is that we're trying to, the industry itself is innovating on renewable energy finance. Last year, NRG, a big member of ours, introduced a yield co. We've heard there's been a lot of discussion about extending master limited partnership coverage to renewable energy. Right now, it only covers conventional. So, conventional energy. So the market got ahead of that. They came up with this YieldCo structure, which is akin to an MLP. Just last week, major financiers announced principles for green bonds to open up a green bond market for renewable energy. That could be a $1 to $2 trillion level of finance, of lower cost, more liquid finance coming to renewable energy. So the industry is innovating. They're not waiting for policy. On the other hand, how these innovations work is still impacted by policy, so we need to adjust that. So we're the industry is innovating, financing on the products that become, they're certainly cost competitive. I think they're poised for incredible growth, and as we go forward, we'll look forward to seeing what Congress can do on that. Andrew, I'll stop there.
Great.
And appreciate the time.
Great. Thank you, Todd. And we'll come back on a couple of those things as well. But with that, I'll turn over to David Walkner here. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Andrew. Just kind of picking up on Scott and Todd, I think that the repeated references to the uncertainty of policy and how that allows business or does not allow business to move forward. One thing that strikes me, this phrase, all of the above, which we hear repeatedly, challenge any of you, count how many times tonight in the State of the Union that gets said, for example. There's something about that phrase, I think, that has become pejorative in Washington now. And I think that's unfortunate because that phrase is quintessentially American, right? We really should be promoting policies, promoting regulations that encourage all of the above, that encourage the use of our domestic resources, whether it be traditional fossil fuel, whether it be alternative technology, whether it be traditional renewables. And I think we have to find a way, and Washington gets mired in this, but I think we have to find a way to support the industries and recognize the substantial advantages that the United States has, both in human capital, in a resource base, and really try to move forward from there. With that as the kind of groundwork, from the oil and gas perspective, what I like to focus on is the use and the movement of the product. So we, of course, hear all the time about production. There's no question about our reserves now. We have got U.S. Geological Survey, we've got EIA, we've got a lot of independent assessment of what our reserves look like. Tremendous opportunity for domestic growth. EIA released its new base reference case in late 2013 for 2014. Expectation of 56% growth in natural gas production over the next 25 years. It's really impressive. Natural gas will be 35% of power generation by, I think they said roughly 2035, overtaking coal. Again, that's a major shift in our market. So if we have that resource base, we need to talk about the use and the movement of the product. And therein, to my mind, is the real benefit to America. So let's look at the use for a minute. Historically, natural gas has not had kind of the political element, if you will, that oil has had for the United States. Not necessarily the case in other parts of the world, but certainly has never risen to the level of political importance. It was always the stepchild of oil. With the new resource base, not just in the U.S., but globally, we're now seeing real opportunities for new demand sinks for that natural gas. So you look at the maritime sector, for example. Prior to 2013, there were no LNG-powered ships in the global fleet. There were none. By the end of 2014, we're going to have roughly 40 LNG-powered ships in the global fleet. And the industry estimates, are that by 2025, there will be a 42-fold increase in that number of vessels. We'll have 1,800 vessels in the global maritime fleet that are powered by LNG. Now, sounds relatively easy, right? I'm sure you convert the engine, no problem. It can be dual fuel in some cases. But the knock-on effect of that, how are those ships going to be fueled, right? Existing ports don't have the infrastructure to actually fuel those vessels. So the ports are going to have to be part of this discussion. The shipping companies are going to be engaged in this discussion. For ports, there's an opportunity for multiple use for the product. So not only are you building a facility for the vessels to come and fuel, but the port, and let's use Tacoma and Seattle as good examples, who are moving down this path already. Tacoma and Seattle are looking at conversion of domestic vehicle fleets for the ports and for the counties and municipalities to run on natural gas. Guess what? They're going to use the same fueling station that the vessels in the port are going to use. It's infrastructure development, it's jobs, it's economic growth, and importantly for a lot of the shipping companies, it is major offsets in their emissions, which is really in the maritime sector what is driving this. It is compliance with a global regime that's coming into effect in 2015. So use for the maritime sector, huge. It's a new demand sink for our natural gas. Locomotives, another great example. We're in the nascent stage right now for this. We are at the cusp. BNSF has publicly announced that they're looking at this. A couple of the other railroads have indicated that they're starting to look at this. But again, industry projections are that there's going to be roughly 30 to 40% penetration of LNG fueled locomotives in the next 10, 15 years. Major, major shift in the fuel profile for these companies. Again, environmental benefits for them, but cost savings are tremendous. Union Pacific, 25% of Union Pacific's costs are fuel. $3.5 billion in 2012. If they convert to run on LNG, the savings are going to be immense for that, for Union Pacific. And all of, I would say that the long-haul locomotives are in the same position. The transportation of the product, again, the benefit to America, and I think that coming back to my opening remarks about how we should be supporting all of the various energy resources, each energy resource from an infrastructure perspective, a jobs perspective, all of them, whether it's renewable alternative technologies, traditional fossil fuels, every one of them has this same knock-on effect in terms of job growth. You look at transportation, the United States has the most robust pipeline infrastructure in the world, oil and gas, both interstate transportation of the product as well as gathering and intrastate transportation. There's no reason we should not further enhance that network that exists in order to help provide fuel for the ports and to provide new trucking fueling facilities, for example. 2013, we put hundreds of miles of new interstate pipeline capacity into service, capable of moving about 4.5 billion cubic feet a day of natural gas. That's substantial. We have four major interstate oil and NGL product pipelines going from the Marcellus down to the Gulf, basically to move ethane to a region and a market where it can actually be used and processed. So a lot of opportunity, a lot of growth, and I think the empirical data in terms of our resource base and in terms of the actual benefit, I think bear out, would support policies that help encourage this development. LNG exports is another one of the uses. I think there's a tendency to view exports of energy as this absolutely unique concept. And again, it rises out of the 1970s, right? That somehow the export of our domestically produced energy is a pariah. And I agree with Senator Murkowski on this. I do think that we need to re-envision our export infrastructure, our export policy. I call, Andrew alluded to this, it's the trifurcation of jurisdiction over oil, natural gas, and coal. And I think we need to have some cohesive structure, some cohesive policy in how agencies are looking at the export of our domestic resources. In terms of LNG specifically, which is clearly crude oil has been percolating significantly over the last 6 to 8 weeks here in Washington. But LNG exports is really right now in the throes of it. And we see substantial investment being introduced into the US economy. I think one of the most notable points of this investment is the amount of new foreign investment into the United States by entities and companies that traditionally have never had a presence in the United States. You look at companies like GAIL of India, PTT of Thailand, the Japanese utilities. Most of these companies have never, ever had a presence in the United States. They are now looking at a vertically integrated position. They are looking at upstream investment. They are looking at investment in pipeline infrastructure, in the LNG export facility, and in the commodity itself. That is an absolute plus to the U.S. economy. We should, certainly from my perspective, we should not be unduly delaying the process and the authorization and the timing to move this product, to get it into the global market. I think the issue has, particularly on gas, because it hadn't been political for so long, it has now been thrust into this spotlight and has probably become unduly politicized. But I expect that we will continue to see movement as FERC moves through the timing for approval of these facilities. When you're looking at $8, $10, $15 billion in investment for one facility, I think it's going to be very difficult for the Department of Energy to sit on applications when only that is the only thing stopping the company from putting a shovel in the ground and actually beginning construction. Suppose maybe that's a good wrap up and open it to
questions. Excellent, thank you. Some commonalities, some differences I heard throughout. I heard uncertainty, and then question, should we do all of the above or should we go with that? I think that's interesting things. I'm going to take the moderator's perspective and ask the first question. And just kind of real quick to each of you, what is the consequences of not making a choice in terms of international competitiveness, in terms of international, David, you had mentioned Gale and the engagement that's ongoing, Sumitomo and all of these companies. Todd, obviously China's a big player here on solar, and there's ongoing issues, and Germany has also staked out its claim, and then on nuclear too, is by not building new plants, are we ceding the next generation of nuclear technology to the other countries? So if I just a couple minutes from each of you guys, and maybe Scott, you can go
sure.
First.
Okay, thank you. I think our biggest issues in the international marketplace are the fact that the government authorization that we need to export commercial nuclear technology is very, very slow and a significant disadvantage to U.S. companies that want to participate in global markets. So over the next 10 years, we have roughly a $740 billion marketplace emerging globally for nuclear energy. There are 71 reactors being built worldwide today. Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East are the key markets that we're looking at. But the issue we have with the U.S. is those companies who want to participate in that market have to get authorization from the Department of Energy under its Part 810 rules to be able to participate directly in countries' building plans. That process, it takes anywhere from 18 to 24 months for U.S. companies to navigate. Other countries do it in a matter of weeks or 3 months. So when your lag time to participate in those international markets is measured in a year to 18 months, it's very, very difficult to compete, particularly when you're competing against France Inc., Russia Inc., China Inc. It's not a level playing field to begin with, and when the federal government puts up roadblocks to commercial participation by U.S. companies, it becomes even more difficult. That's a significant disadvantage to us. We are participating with the Department of Energy in a process to change that rule. We've done a number of studies that indicate it can be done, it should be done. And that's a key function for U.S. technology to compete in the marketplace. We believe we still have the best nuclear technology available. The Chinese are building U.S. technology. Other countries are looking seriously at signing contracts for U.S. technology, the same technology that we're building today in Georgia and South Carolina. So we believe we not only have the best technology, we have the best safety culture to export, and that's a significant factor for an industry that's dependent on safe operation no matter what country these plants are operating in. And we have the best regulatory framework as well that, that many countries come into the U.S. To look at as an example. So if we can participate in these global markets, each $1 billion that we export is equivalent to about 15,000 U.S. jobs. And we're taking minority stakes in some projects. Westinghouse has a minority stake in the new reactors being built by South Korea and the UAE. But we want the majority stake of these projects. We don't want the minority stake. And to do that, we need to continue to move our bilateral agreements with some of these trading partners through Congress. We have several of these 1-2-3 agreements that we'll be moving this year. And we need to change the rules at the Department of Energy so we get faster ruling on export to those countries. So those are the two things that we're really looking at in terms of competing internationally.
Thank you. Todd, I mean, do you see China and Germany especially have been had very aggressive plans for renewable energy, deployment of renewable energy, and real certainty, I think.
Yeah.
And does that, the uncertainty here in the United States, does that cost us investment? Does that cost us jobs?
I think so, and if you looked at the data, I think it would make the case. I think what distinguishes the U.S. from what China and Germany have done is the long-term commitment, the point of certainty. It was about a little over 10 years ago that Germany implemented their feed-in tariff, and we've seen massive deployment in renewable energy, solar and wind. In Germany over the last number of years, we saw massive investment in manufacturing, all kinds of economic activity. I think now where renewables are about 26-27% solar and wind of their total power. And then in May of last year, one day in May, 52% of all the power on the grid came from solar, which is kind of interesting. So interested at scale, and it's a long-term commitment. It's still there, and it's being, the policies are being modified appropriately. On China too, again, a long-term strategic signal to the market that the Chinese government sees an important role for renewable energy going forward. And I think that spiked a tremendous amount of interest in China, not only in the domestic manufacturing early on, the last 8 years or 5 to 8 years or so, but we also saw a lot of the Western companies partner and invest in Chinese manufacturing of solar panels and wind turbines. So now China is moving towards not only driving manufacturing of the products, but deployment of the products in their country. So that's a massive opportunity going forward. By contrast, here in the U.S., I think as most people know that the technologies were invented in the United States. The market was really developed in Germany to start. And then China has played probably the strongest role in the manufacturing base. So huge impact. We've seen growth in the U.S. industry for sure, but not at the scale that we've seen in these other countries. And I think that's a missed opportunity. And I think right now, even today, it's a question because the policy uncertainty is having an impact. Over the last couple of years, following. The 1603 cash grant incentive, and then with that expiring, and the uncertainty about the PTC, we've actually seen wind companies who are manufacturing here reduce the number of jobs, if not close. So I think there's been a real impact on that front. I think the way forward, though, is if you're in the business, it starts with the market. If you have a strong market, they will come. The manufacturers will make strategic decisions on how to get the products to the market and so on. So that's what I think we need to do. We need to focus on if we can, look at, again, a long-term program, a long-term certainty about the policy, you know, that's the strongest thing we can do, I think, to, you know, drive the market.
Yeah. Yeah, and David, I just real quick, I feel like I see news reports all the time of, oh, Australia's got a new LNG plant coming on, and Norway, and the Russians building LNG export facility in Vladivostok. And is there danger that if we don't move fast here, we miss that market? We miss the, you know, American exporters won't have the export capacity?
There's certainly, you're right, there's a lot of discussion about this point. It is, natural gas has become a global commodity. There's no question about it. You look at the Australia, and that is usually, the Australian projects are usually those that are cited most frequently on this. The Australian projects are saddled with a number of problems themselves in terms of cost overruns. Cost of labor in Australia is staggering compared to the United States. There will be some missed opportunities. There's no question. If we continue to delay, there will be some missed opportunities. But I also think it is a bit hyperbolic to state that the entire U.S. export market is going to fall on its face if we don't get every single project approved. Having said that, I come back to my earlier statement that the DOE license should not be, given all of the data out there about our available resource base, about the delta between supply and demand over the next 20 years in the U.S. for natural gas, the barrier to entry should not be the Department of Energy export license. That, to my mind, that should be a basic concept. But you look at the global players that are coming into the U.S., the Japanese utilities in particular, they're not looking to have U.S. gas supply all of their needs. Tokyo Electric Power, Kansai Electric Power, Tokyo Gas, they are still executing contracts on a regular basis with production out of Australia, with production out of Qatar, with production out of East Africa, which is going to be a huge, huge arrival in the late latter part of this decade and early next decade. It is a global commodity. All of those projects will move forward. From my perspective, the U.S. should just have a piece of that global
cool.
industry.
Thank you. Maybe we'll open it up to questions. We've got only about 5 minutes, so we'll take a couple here, and then we'll see. Yeah, right down. Do we have a microphone? Yeah, hold on to the microphone.
Are we on?
Yeah.
Doug Martin, I'm a local consultant. I was very impressed with your investment statistics on the renewable side and on the gas side over recent years, and presumably those are based upon valuations that the market sees. I've heard a lot of comments over the last 30 years about let the market work, don't have the government choose. One of the things that's changed since the 70s, though, is that we have seen the investment market look at some of the fossil fuel resources as stranded assets. Tens of trillions of dollars of stranded assets. As the market begins to move away from that, does that accentuate the movement toward renewables and toward new gas? Does it accentuate the transition, or does it set us up for a requirement that the government find a way to protect the fossil fuel industries that is being beaten down by the renewables and gas?
Yeah, I think that I think there's a piece in your report, Andrew, too, that talks about the existing coal plants. I think actually the number I had was that more than about 75% of the existing coal plants or so are more than 30 years old.
Yeah.
And there's a major, major pressure on the environmental side through the Clean Air Act. Think about the 1990 Clean Air Act, and then of course the 1970 Clean Air Act, 70, right? Yeah. I mean that may be the most important driver of what's going on in energy, frankly, mm-hmm. today, because that is putting a pressure on the aging coal fleet. And what I think we all know is in this room is that it's bringing forward the retirements, but what's accentuating that point is also the cost competitiveness of natural gas and renewables, because not only are they does it entail greater investment spend on controls, environmental controls, but you've got alternatives, and I think that that's accelerating this something of this transition, We expect that to continue because renewable energy, the costs are continue to come down. One thing with regard to Germany, where we've seen scale markets development, basic economics 101, as the volume increases, unit costs come down. We barely touched the surface in the U.S. I have this great slide that shows the cost comparison, nuclear, coal, gas, wind, and solar. We have come down like this, but with very little market penetration. That's going to continue to grow. The costs are going to continue to come down. Germany is installing solar about almost half the price we're installing here. So there's a lot of progress to be made there. And so I think that hastens the transition. So it's a combination of market forces, technology development, and yes, policy, for sure. I think the policy point, though, is none of this is, it's a free market in its purest form. There's rules and frameworks around all of this that I think, Andrew's and the American Security Project is making the point we need to modernize all that. Plus, we've got an advent of all new kinds of technology, aside from solar and wind. You've got smart grid and you've got all these other things that are happening that the policy needs to catch up with.
I would just add to that, the definition of stranded assets is necessarily a shifting definition.
Yeah.
And that's because of technology. And we see this in the gas world, right? I mean, that is what the shale boom is all about. What once was a stranded asset, you just couldn't get to it, you couldn't figure out how to break it free from the shale, is now a monetized asset for companies. One of the movements that I think is going to help shape the future of the gas business in the U.S. and globally is small-scale LNG. And we are starting, I have a number of clients who are hedge funds, and we're seeing a pretty substantial focus on investment into some new technologies to monetize stranded gas assets in a small-scale manner. So figuring out how to, putting a small-scale facility in the middle of the Bakken where we're flaring all of that gas so you don't have to build a massive pipeline infrastructure to get the gas out of there. Putting small modularized LNG production into a port, for example, where it can have multiple uses. Again, that shifts the definition of what a stranded asset is. So I think would probably agree with Todd and kind of his conclusion that it really is multiple pieces that affect how that comes out ultimately.
I want to add just one piece of perspective on that is when you see the shifting happening in the electric sector. What's going away is a lot of baseload power when you start retiring coal plants and you replace it with renewables or small scale gas. You can bring large combined cycle gas on as long as you have the capacity to move that gas into those markets. And that's a lot of gas when you're looking at large-scale combined cycle gas plants. So what we see is this recognition that as large amounts of coal, baseload power gets taken off, how do we replace that power in a way that's going to preserve the baseload capacity that we need in those markets? And so there's a lot of recognition that we've got to maintain the foundation of that baseload power. Obviously, nuclear is a solution to that. Obviously, combined cycle gas is a solution. We're bringing small-scale reactors into design right now that we hope will be a solution around the 2020 timeframe. And from a capital outlay standpoint, will be a huge reduction in the capital the utilities have to lay out for nuclear at one time. So you could build these in a modular way where you add anywhere from 50 to a little less than 300 megawatts onto the grid at one time and preserve that baseload capacity that you need. So that's one of the challenges that we have as we look forward at replacing some of the large coal plants that are going off and how to replace them in a way that preserves the reliability that we need. The German experience has been discussed here quite a bit. If you look at some of the wind energy that they have 7 to 10 day gaps in their wind performance where it's very, very high on some days, but it's very, very low on others. We saw the same thing in Texas when the polar vortex moved through. As the front moved through, wind was very significant in keeping the grid up. But after the front went through, the next day, it bottomed out again. So that's why baseload is so important to the grid. and why you need, really, I hate to get back to this mix of technologies, but you have to have the mix of technologies that are going to be able to prop up that reliability regardless of the situation you're facing.
And I would just add that the reality is that we have a very, you know, it is about mix. We have a current mix that, you know, is moving around and shifting, but we don't, I think history has proven, we all know this, that we don't want to be dependent on any single source. What's more is that there's some complementary elements of some of these technologies as well. So I think that's real important going forward. And the only thing I would say is that we are in this period of, again, it seems like outdated policy. The market deals with the framework, innovates, and it moves around that. But, you know, we've got an aging fleet on the power side. We've got uncertainty in the fuels market. And then you've got advent of new technology. You've got all the digital technologies and issues surrounding that. So I think what the market's clamoring for is a little bit more of some guidance from the policy on that side. Very important.
Well, I think that's going to have to be our last word. Thank you all for coming, and join me in thanking our panelists here.